welcome everyone to Citizens Climate University tonight. We're very lucky to have a topic that's near and dear to many people's interests, international updates from around the world and the work that CCL is doing globally. With us tonight to share in these updates are our very own Joe Robertson. Joe works with CCL volunteers in Africa, Asia, Europe, Latin America, and the Pacific, and leads CCE's engagement with the United Nations, the Carbon Pricing Leadership Coalition, and other multilateral institutions, which we'll get the chance to hear about tonight. He's also the lead strategist in a series of diplomatic dialogues aimed at accelerating the global transition to a climate-smart, sustainable economy. We'll also get to hear about that tonight. Thanks so much for being on the line, Joe. And we also have Kathy Orlando with us. Kathy, prior to working with Citizens Climate Education, served as a science outreach manager to the Dean of Science and Engineering at Laurentian University, and she started CCL's first international chapter back in September of 2010. And by November of 2011, she was directing CCL Canada as a full-time volunteer. Kathy now works as Citizens Climate Education's international outreach manager, where she draws upon 13 years of experience in science communication, organizational development, and volunteer empowerment. And we're really lucky to have you on the call tonight too, Kathy. Just to give a quick learning goal overview for tonight's lesson, we're hoping that volunteers will be able to take away two main things. First, to identify exciting current developments happening around the world in CCL groups outside of the United States. We often talk a lot about our own domestic policy and focus, but what are we doing globally? We're also going to focus on helping participants gain familiarity with the important institutions that are working internationally to build climate agreement and how CCL, especially through Joe and Kathy's leadership, is engaging those institutions.
Thank you, Brett. So we have an ambitious evening tonight. We will be doing continental updates, looking at what was happening with the IPCC, and then segueing into macro critical drivers, and then a G7 update, the Carbon Pricing Leadership Coalition, and an international dialogue that is happening. And then finally, we'll have questions and answers. So before I start, I just want to say I was at a conference earlier this week, and if I use any acronyms or any lingo that you don't understand, call me out in the chat, and I'll try not to do that. I also want to say that the continental updates that I will be giving you are recent updates. So I'm not going to do a full-scale history of what has been happening across CCL internationally for the past 5 to 6 years. I'm actually focusing on what's been going on in the last 3 or 4 months. So today I went to the CCL map, and if you've been following the map, you may have noticed they finally got 2 more chapters on that map today. The newest chapters to Citizens Climate Lobby are in Colombia, in South America, and in Madagascar, which is off the coast of Africa. And I'm going to jump into the regions and the continents. So Citizens Climate Lobby, Latin America, Tammy Kellogg and Isatis Citron are co-leading Citizens Climate Lobby Latin America. It's January, and they are in many of the groups right now are in the stage of developing their plans for 2018. But a lot of things happened in the last few months, you may have noticed, or if you haven't, I'm going to tell you about them. Citizens Climate Lobby now has Spanish resources. There's the Citizens Climate Lobby webpage, as well as a Citizens Climate Lobby Twitter handle. And if you want to find more about Citizens Climate Lobby Panama, they also have a Facebook page, a Twitter handle, as well as a website. A couple things that have happened. I don't know if you recognize in the picture on the left, if you're looking at the screen, Peter Brin, who has taken a year off to travel around the world, went to Panama and met with some of the CCL Panama members recently. And Citizens Climate Lobby Colombia got off the ground, and they got off the ground in a big way late in 2017. They had their first meeting. They watched the call, and then they planned ahead, and they've already started lobbying politicians. For those of you who do not know, Colombia has a carbon pricing policy already. It's at $5 a ton, and Citizens Climate Lobby Colombia is working towards making that policy better. Citizens Climate Lobby Africa is now what I'd like to talk about, what has been going on in the past few months. They have been planning. Most of the groups in Africa have been on these a series of teleconference calls where they've been planning for a continental conference in Africa in June. And it'll be the first African conference for Citizens Climate Lobby. And at that conference, they are basically going to be trained up to be citizen climate lobbyists. They're going to receive the climate advocate training. They're going to advance their communications on and lobbying skills. They're going to learn how to deliver climate presentations. They're going to delve more deeply into carbon fee and dividend, and they're going to have a lobby day, and it will be in Abuja. Most of the African countries are currently right now focusing more on plastic pollution and coal, except for Cameroon. They have had great luck in Citizens Climate Lobby Cameroon, lobbying their politicians to the point where a federal politician had asked them to give them a two-page summary of carbon fee and dividend. So late in the year, in last year in November and December, we helped the CCL Bamenda group and Alex and his group there in Bamenda, Cameroon, develop a two-page carbon fee and dividend policy, transpose what we've already developed in Canada and the United States into the context for Cameroon, and it's been presented to a politician. So that was really exciting to hear that a politician in Africa is now reading about a carbon fee and dividend because of the work, the great work of our volunteers there. If you look down at Madagascar, we have a new chapter there. So she's not quite in the loop of the conference for what's going on in Africa, but she's already developed a two-page plan. Her name is Juana Colom, and she has developed a two-page document of her plans. It's basically a climate action plan for Madagascar, and it will be involving youth mobilization from the grassroots level to gain more political will for climate action in Madagascar. I had the privilege of interviewing Mike a couple weeks ago to talk about his work in Africa. And a couple years ago, he went to Lagos, Nigeria. And before he went there, he wasn't quite sure how successful, you know, how powerful citizens could be in lobbying their politicians, but they actually made great headway with the politicians there. They had success, they had great dialogue. And through his work, in Africa, Mike said the following: "I've come to believe that if citizens come together in their communities and societies and demand change, they will get change. It may not be perfect, but they will get change." And that is if you could hear his voice when he said that on the interview, I'd hope you'd be as inspired as I was. So we also have chapters in the Pacific region of the world, and a lot has been happening in Australia, so I will just focus there. The big thing that happened in Australia is Rod Mitchell, the founding CCL coordinator, has created an incredible transitional plan because he's stepping away and he's handing over the reins of Citizens Climate Lobby Australia to Jody Green. He's been working on it for the past 6 months. Thankfully, Rod will be staying on his chair of CCL Australia, and that's wonderful because he will be able to keep the institutional wisdom he has gained within the last 4 years at the helm of CCL Australia within CCL Australia. CCL Australia has already made a plan for 2018, which I think Canada might steal for 2019. Anyways, and their plan is to have a series of regional conferences so that they can specifically target regions of Australia and grow the CCL Australia group there. And their first conference is in just under 3 weeks, and it will be in Perth, Western Australia. We also have groups in Asia. I would like to just focus in on India. CCL India has, I think, 8 chapters, and their leader is Raj Bhukan, and we've been speaking on teleconference calls. Raj wants to take a very holistic view of India, linking climate change, water, and biodiversity in CCL India, but he wants to work specifically on carbon pricing. He's just taking the viewpoint from that angle, and they're in the process of developing a plan for India, because in 2019 there will be an election in India, and they will be working on carbon pricing to help him with his communications to the politicians as well as the citizens. We took a Canadian cartoon, which for those of you who can see the screen is on the left, that explains how carbon fee and dividend works, and we transposed it into the India context. India is of special note. At the Paris Agreement in 2015, Prime Minister Modi, he made an incredible, he was very important in the success of the Paris Agreement in 2015. I don't have time to go into detail, but India is a powerhouse, and getting India on board is really important. Citizens Climate Lobby Europe has a lot going on and a lot of chapters. They actually meet once a week on a teleconference call, and they update each other. They meet once a week. Citizens Climate Lobby Portugal has been working with civil society groups or NGOs or groups like Citizens Climate Lobby and in Portugal to get them to endorse a carbon fee and dividend-like policy in Portugal. So they have a whole series of civil society groups that have endorsed it, and they are going to meet for the third time with the Ministry of the Environment for Portugal to present what they've been doing with carbon fee and dividends. So they already have their third meeting, which means they're getting invited back, which is really exciting. Citizens Climate Lobby United Kingdom has had a successful letter writing campaign recently. And Citizens Climate Lobby Germany has 2 really exciting things in coming up. In March, they're going to have a breakfast with their federal representatives in Berlin with all parties, and they will be discussing carbon pricing and climate change at that breakfast. So because I'm Canadian, I'll say parliament, but a parliamentary breakfast with their representatives of the various parties. That's very exciting. And they are also going to have, I believe it is their 4th lobbying days as well as conference in June at the same time that we will be in Washington, D.C. Lastly, CCL Sweden, they were the second international country to come on board, and they have a great relationships and have ongoing actions with their federal representatives. And I'll tell you about Canada in a moment, but when Canada announced advances in their carbon pricing policy, CCL Sweden actually emailed their parliamentarians what was happening in Canada, and they got responses from 12 of the parliament of their federal representatives in Sweden about Canada's carbon pricing policy. And that segues me to Canada. Those are our volunteers. About two-thirds of them showed up for the picture on the on our last lobbying day. This past year, I just wanted to say that Citizens Climate Lobby Canada has done a bang-up job of print, of getting published on the editorial pages. We were published 701 times. We met with some high-powered politicians the last time we went to lobby, and I cannot stress enough how important it is to document what you are doing, because when we say these numbers to politicians, first of all, it makes their eyes get really big. They're like, oh, they're serious. And then they really want to talk to us because they know we're organized. So it's a great way to, if you, the more organized you are and the more data you have, the better. Very quickly, the senator that we were working with, he when the election happened in 2015, he told us that you've done so much groundwork that can really start to pay off. I feel the prospects for climate action are exceptional. And so just very quickly, what's happened in Canada. In 2015, we got a new government. By December 2015, Canada's Environment Commissioner, Environment and Climate Change Minister, Catherine McKenna, took the lead at the UN negotiations in Paris, especially the Carbon Pricing Leadership Coalition. By October 2016, we had a framework for climate action in Canada to include all the provinces and territories. It's called the PAM, Canadian Framework on Climate Change and Clean Growth. And then in January 2018, this framework is now becoming a law. And the government announced the backstop policies for our national carbon pricing policy. And it looks like it'll be revenue neutral. And if provinces and territories choose to not have their own carbon pricing policy, this federal backstop carbon pricing policy will be revenue neutral, and all the money will be returned to the citizens, all the money will be returned to the provinces, and the Prime Minister is indicating that he wants it to be given directly to the citizens, sounding a lot like carbon fee and dividend, but we'll have to wait for the final details, which will come out at the end of this year. Currently, 86% of Canada's population is covered by a carbon price, and by the beginning of 2019, it will be 100%. So we're going to do some Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change updates. So the Intergovernmental Panel on climate Change has been around since 1990, and what they are scientists, about 2,000 of them, scientists from social sciences as well as the hard sciences, come together and they look at the peer-reviewed literature, and these updates and documents that they produce are guiding policies to government around the world, and they use peer-reviewed science. Citizens Climate Lobby was an observer at the 46th plenary of the IPCC, and our primary role there was to ensure the integrity of the process, determining the chapters of the sixth report of the IPCC, which will come out in 2022. And if you've been following the IPCC, you'll know that the last one was in 2013, 2014. So, and if you want to look, there's a detailed process on how these reports are produced, and I'm not going to go into detail, but if you want to go back. So here's some updates from the IPCC in Montreal. There will be more social sciences than ever in the sixth report. It will come out in October 22. There'll be case studies weaved throughout. And that's never been done before. They're actually going to be looking at case studies. For the first time, Indigenous knowledge will be included in the IPCC, so they're looking at ways on how they can take Indigenous knowledge, which is not peer-reviewed, and including it in the IPCC, and there are ways to do this. Other United Nations agencies do include Indigenous knowledge, and there was beginning steps to it taken towards having gender equity for the scientists that put together the IPCC reports, beginning steps. It's not there yet, but it was really nice to see at the conference. And for those of you who can't wait until 2022 for reports from the IPCC, there will be a global warming report in 2018 of the 1.5 degree, as well as oceans and cryosphere report in 2019, and climate change and land in 2019. Now, The IPCC is a United Nations agency, and what happens at the IPCC feeds into the United Nations, and this is my segue to Joe.
It's so exciting to see what's happening with people all over the world doing doing what CCL volunteers do. So this word macrocritical, I'm kind of evangelizing it a bit, and I think some people find it intimidating, but it's a very simple idea. What it basically means is a macrocritical driver of overall value potential is something that changes the possibility for an entire economy at the macro scale. So here's an example. A few years ago, there was a major rainstorm in St. Vincent and the Grenadines. And in 3 hours of rain, that small island lost 15% of its GDP. So that 15% impact is a major macro impact, a critical impact on that economy and its future potential. Puts a country back 10, 20 years in terms of overall development standards. And in the words of one IMF executive director, actually, I think, Kathy, you were there with me when we heard this. When that kind of thing happens, you no longer know what the value of a dollar is. You can say you're investing $100 million, but maybe it's only worth $30 million because of all of the change that's in the system. So those are macro-critical changes or macro-critical drivers of value. So the next slide shows you the kind of thing that the IPCC is trying to get a handle on, which is the scientific observation of Earth systems. Here is a famous image. It's a historic image from the NOAA GOES system. Essentially Earth-observing satellites telling us about weather in real time and then cross-referencing that against all the background data. What you see here is historic because never before in recorded history had three major tropical cyclones made landfall at exactly the same time. But here you see in the center Hurricane Irma, on the right Hurricane Jose, and on the left Hurricane Katia hitting Mexico's coastline, all three making landfall at exactly the same time. Never observed before. This is part of the demonstration of climate change being itself a macro critical impact. And if we go to the next slide, you see another way in which those impacts get into our everyday lives. So this slide from the World Resources Institute shows you water resource stress across Syria and the Middle East. And when you zoom into Syria, as we've done here, you can see these two dark red areas on the map of Syria, one in the far northeast and one along the western edge of the country. Keep in mind exactly where those two regions are, far northeast, the whole western edge. As we go to the next slide and we look at a satellite image of what is going on in Syria, what you see is that the brown area that is most of the country is less water stressed than the far northeast and the far western edge. That's because it's not normally green, but those two regions that are experiencing extreme water resource stress are normally green. Those are food growing areas. That's where the agricultural economy of Syria is based. And during its 12 years of extreme drought, unprecedented in modern history, that economy collapsed completely. And so you then had the situation where, if we go to the next slide, people who would want to make their living growing food, selling produce, putting that into the national marketplace, ended up being displaced because there was no way to live where they are. So food systems are macro critical because they change everything about what's possible for a country. And not just in the way they did in Syria, where war ensued. But if you remember, when that started to happen in Syria, that was a little bit after the Arab Spring had started. And what started the Arab Spring in Tunisia was food prices. When you have too many people who don't have enough money and there's no way to make a living and food is scarce at the same time, which means food prices are extremely high, even for normal times, but there's no way to pay for them, that's a macro critical driver. And that's going to change everything about what's politically possible. In Tunisia, it meant the end of a decades-old dictatorship, and then in Egypt next door as well. So if we go to the next slide, when we start thinking about what happens in these cases, what are other cases like this? That case of St. Vincent is mentioned here. These are actually CCL volunteers in Nepal who were responding along with the Red Cross as citizen volunteers trying to help people out after the earthquake that happened a couple years ago. A climate impact that people don't realize happens in Nepal is glacial melt makes landslides more common. This is a mountain country, so whole towns and villages just disappear down the mountainside or under the mountainside, depending on their situation. That's getting worse. The floods in Pakistan that we've heard and how they interact with drought, Nigeria's desertification, which is worse than Syria's, and it's worse for all kinds of reasons, including the already existing violence and the fact that there are far more people in Nigeria. Yemen, the first country to run out of fresh water. As we speak, Cape Town, South Africa is about to become the first major city in the world to run out of drinking water. And it's not clear that's going to be able to be prevented. Louisiana has been losing a football field of land per hour. Siberia's permafrost problem is everybody's problem. It's not just a macro critical driver for Russia, which if 60% of the land area of Russia is partly frozen ground part of the year, and that hard ground is now going to be mush for decades to come because of that ongoing melting process. The ensuing fallout of that change in the economic dynamics of the region is going to hit everybody everywhere. So if we go to the next slide, this is maybe an opportunity to talk about why the IPCC is looking at these social science indicators and thinking about things like gender equity and thinking about things like indigenous knowledge, because those social influences can have a macro-critical effect. And with the IPCC looking at the atmosphere and the oceans and the state of the warming of the earth, it's necessary now that we are as interconnected as we are and we can make these connections to actually talk about what is the impact on our overall capability. In December, the president of France, who you see pictured there, hosted the One Planet Summit along with the World Bank and the UN Secretary General. We got to be there to be part of it, partly because we've been engaging with some of these institutions to help them think about how do we do the complicated work of connecting people on the ground in communities to situations of crisis, to macro critical indicators that if we can think ahead, we can use as levers to make change happen faster. And so the summit was created in order to make sure that financial leaders, heads of state, finance ministers, central bank governors, investment banks, trading firms, major commercial banks, insurance companies, that they could all come together around an increasing level of commitment to stop doing the things that are creating all of this chaos and start doing the things that make us more secure, more resilient. So if we go to the next slide, what you see here is the first open dialogue between parties and non-party stakeholders during the COP process as an official contribution to the meeting of the conference of the parties. Now, what that means is the countries that are part of the UN Convention on Climate Change, they are sitting down with civil society organizations, business coalitions, subnational governments, meaning mayors and governors, etc. And they are talking about how do we make all of this work for all of us, so that we're not leaving this all in the hands of the executive branch of nation state governments. And we're actually including everybody and everybody's pushing in the same direction. It makes everybody's life easier and it makes it possible for those governments to be more ambitious. So in what we've done with the CCL way of engaging government is we've made recommendations over the last several years to the Climate Secretariat of the UN for how we can actually get citizens' voices into these rooms. So this was a success because there's a whole coalition of organizations around, you know, thousands of organizations around the world that are trying to push for stakeholders' voices to be included directly in the process. This was the beginning of making that an official part of how things work. And what's really wonderful is that the proposals that we've made over the years have filtered into the official process. And so if we go to the next slide, What you see is kind of a symbolic representation of what's called now the Talanoa Dialogue. The Paris Agreement requires that all of the countries that have signed it hold what they call a facilitative dialogue, where essentially the countries help to facilitate each other's success. They share learning and best practices, etc. This year, in December of 2018, as part of the process of assessing progress and planning for the 2020 target, where a lot of people think if countries don't have national plans that are on track, we will have lost the climate solutions game. So the Talanoa Dialogue is an innovation from Fiji, and you see here members of the Fijian delegation, citizens from Fiji, and what they're doing is they're essentially celebrating the presence of a former California governor, the current mayor of Bonn, and civil society organizations that are all going to spend the next year contributing to this open dialogue. Fiji managed to work with stakeholders to take the advice of civil society organizations and to leverage its own culture of open dialogue to make this year a year-long open dialogue, open to every living soul on earth. Every person who can manage to put together some kind of submission that's substantive can make recommendations to the Conference of the Parties, and their voices can be heard in the process. So why that's so important to us is that we've actually designed a toolkit for that very purpose, and we've been using it to help facilitate some of this engagement over the years as an example. Just one last word here about dialogue and what it does. Opening up the decision-making process to people from different sectors, people from different levels of influence, people from entirely different fields of political thinking. What it does is it allows the people in the decision-making position to think differently than they otherwise would. And so for the last few years, we have been co-convening with a number of other organizations, including the International Center for Dialogue and Peacebuilding, the Norwegian Nobel Institute, a series of diplomatic dialogues. And what we heard from the stakeholders, governments, financial decision makers, NGOs, economists, and other experts, was that we need to find a way to give non-expert decision makers, people who don't know enough about climate, a way to make really smart climate choices without first becoming experts. It's not fair to the world that the only way to make good climate decisions is to learn enough about science and economics to become an expert. So this tool, Resilience Intel, is now something that we're building through a coalition effort to facilitate that kind of guidance. And that's my handoff to Kathy to talk about facilitating the work of the G7 in terms of improving on climate goals.
I was at a conference earlier this week where there was a lot of lingo. So I was at a G7 task force meeting. And for those of you who are unaware, the G7 is a group of seven countries that are of the most richest countries in the world. So Canada is, in 2018, the president of the G7. And in December, Canada announced its themes for the G7. And so working together, so there are five things Canada will be doing, excitingly, and we're happy to announce that they will want the G7 to work together on climate change, oceans, and clean energy, preparing for clean jobs of the future, investing in growth that works for everyone, advancing gender equality and women's empowerment, and building a more peaceful and secure world. And for anyone who's been in climate change for a long time, I'm sure you see the connections between all of those threads. And for 2 days this week, I was at a conference. Next slide, please. And what we were doing was preparing our final asks to the G7 Sherpas. So what is a G7 Sherpa? They're the personal representative of the G7 leaders who assist in the negotiations of the preparation for the G7 summit, which will take place in Canada, June 8th and June 9th. And the countries are, if you don't know them, are Canada, France, United States, United Kingdom, Germany, Japan, and Italy. We've been building up towards since September. I went to a conference where we got to see a live interview and have audience questions to Canada's G7 Sherpa, Peter Beam. And then I joined the Climate and Energy G7 Task Force Committee, and we've been shaping the asks that we will be give the G7 Sherpas at this meeting for the last 4 months, and then we finalized it. And here is the task force, and the previous slide was the G7 Sherpas, and these are amazing people. And we got to not just think of climate and energy, but also peace and security, food, health, education, and just listen to each other for 2 days straight. And my connections of climate change to everything have been deeply enhanced by this process. We had to take a 2-page ask and condense it down to a 1/2-page ask. And we wove women and children into peace and security into our ask. We had to give attainable asks and process, and we want them to raise the ambition of their climate action. We want them to follow through on their commitment to phase out fossil fuel subsidies, and we want them to increase the amount of money they're giving from public and private resources to support climate action in developing resources. And the full details are on this slide, so you can read them. So that is just an example of how citizen engagement and ultimately can feed up into the executive branches of our government.
Thank you, Kathy. So great to hear about that progress and to know that you were there as part of the task force representing everyone in this organization, I think, very well. So just we wanted to close this kind of update on what we're up to with two big announcements about progress that's developed over the last few years. The Carbon Pricing Leadership Coalition is something that Kathy mentioned came together in the year before the Paris Agreement, and on the first day of the Paris Climate Conference in 2015, it launched officially. And what it is, which it was described by Rachel Kite, who's a senior UN diplomat who presided over the planning of this process, what the Carbon Pricing Leadership Coalition is, which is so far outside the bounds of normal global governance, is a multilateral coalition. It includes nations that also includes non-governmental organizations, businesses, including some of the world's biggest oil companies, and UN agencies like the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, etc. There are also now universities that have been added to it, like Yale and MIT. The thing that's unique is that at this table, this round table, everyone is equal. If the United Kingdom, Britain, wants to present its plans for what the coalition should be doing, the Environmental Defense Fund or Citizens Climate Lobby can also do the same. And it's an inclusive process, and it's been remarkably effective. In the first high-level assembly 2 years ago, it was decided that the short-term goal over time for 2025 would be to influence political processes to bring carbon pricing coverage of total global emissions to at least 50% by the year 2025. And with China announcing its starting its national carbon market, we're actually getting there much faster than people expected. The third annual high-level assembly will take place in April at the World Bank, and we will be there to bring the Citizens Climate Lobby perspective, to bring the kind of principles that we think carbon pricing should follow, covering the whole economy, pricing upstream, limiting of assets and paper instruments that may or may not correspond to real-world emissions reductions, and making sure that revenue is returned to households so that economies keep building in a smart way. And then the last thing that it's going to happen right after this during what's called the SB 48, which is the 48th meeting of the subsidiary bodies to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. Essentially, these are the collections of nation states and other actors that are responsible for planning how to meet the climate convention's challenges. Because we've been talking to some of the governments that have been instrumental in changing the conversation about finance over the last few years, and because we now are proposing to take resilience intelligence as a concept, not just the project that we're working on, but the concept itself, and make that the focus of the high-level ministerial dialogue where finance ministers will come together to talk about climate finance during December's climate negotiations. A couple of those countries have said, why don't we hold an open meeting like the one that you saw where people were sitting around the table and the countries and the NGOs and stakeholders were together at the table. Why don't we hold an open meeting during the SB 48 in May and discuss how this can happen? Let countries share their vision of what kind of resilience intelligence they have and how much they want to accumulate and how they're going to go about doing that. And as observers, we will then have the role of helping to plan and convene this and also helping these countries to learn from each other. And so it's an opportunity that's arisen because of the work of CCL volunteers around the world, helping to build relationships with their governments, and then us having the opportunity to take that and turn it into another level of assistance to those governments. So it's a vote of confidence in what all of you are doing. And I wanted to make sure that we included that. It's something that's still in the planning, but it's a very big deal and a very big sign of the success of what you do every day. And if enough countries join the meeting, it'll be in this room that you see right there.
If you know of anyone who is really focused on carbon pricing and really great at community organizing in countries around the world, please send them our way. We don't have the resources to take somebody who's a really raw recruit. We want a ready-made CCLer at this point. That would be really helpful.
Well, let's just close by this. So if you have any questions after tonight, my contact information as well as Kathy and Joe's are available right here. It's just Kathy or JR or Brent at citizensclimate.org. But on behalf of all of CCL and the successful work that you are accomplishing throughout this country and beyond, as we found out tonight, thank you, thank you, thank you for your dedication, and thank you for being on tonight's webinar, everyone.
Thank you, Brett. Thank you, everybody.
Great stuff.